Good afternoon. I want to welcome you all to Research Plus Pizza. This is a series that we try to do every month during the fall and during the spring semesters, where we have research presentations from presenters who come from across the campus to talk about the work that they do outside the classroom and share that with you. Like I said, there's still food over there, so please do go ahead and get your food. And then I'll talk to you about just a couple of housekeeping issues that we have here. This lunchtime lecture series is brought to you by the University of Texas Libraries, and it features research presentations from faculty across the university. It is generously supported by local company Austin's Pizza, who has been supporting us since the beginning, practically, when this program started in 2011. So do go and help yourself to the drinks and pizza over there, courtesy of Austin's Pizza. I want to bring to your attention that there are, in fact, some trash and recycling stations at the back, so please, you know what to do with those. Today's program is recorded for a podcast, and so when you have a question, raise your hand, and I will come to you with the microphone so that we can capture your question for the podcast later, okay? The other thing, you probably noticed a little half sheet on your chair there. That is our feedback form. We very much appreciate you filling those out. If you don't have a pencil, there's some pencils on these little side areas here in the boxes. You can grab a pencil and fill it out and then leave your feedback form in the chair. Especially let us know if you have suggestions of either topics or presenters that you would like to hear. That's how we find fabulous people like the presenter that we're going to have for you in a couple of minutes. It takes a village to put on this program, and here's just some of the people who have worked very hard to get this together for you today, so big thanks to them. We also have a program coming up in November with Robert Young from Architecture, who is the founder of the Sustainable Cities Initiative when he was at the University of Oregon, and who will come and talk about Sustainable Cities Initiatives for us next month. And so now let me tell you about Professor John Clark. He received his PhD from Yale University and began teaching at UT Austin in 1980. He's the Annie Laurie Howard Regents Professor in Fine Arts and currently is the co-director of the Aplantis Project, who's been working since 2005 to complete the study, excavation, and publication of two Roman villas buried by Vesuvius in AD 79. With the endorsement of the Italian Ministry of Culture, the Aplantis Project has completed the first of four volumes on Villa A, which will appear in digital form. All the research findings will be accessed through a navigable 3D digital model that links to a project database housed at the Texas Advanced Computing Center. Dr. Clark's most recent books are Looking at Laughter, Humor, Power, and Transgression in Roman Visual Culture, 100 BC to AD 250, and Roman Life, 100 B.C. to A.D. 200. Looking at Laughter examines the intersection of class and humor in a variety of settings. Roman Life is geared to non-specialist readers and follows individuals known to us from archaeological evidence through the events of their daily lives. He teaches courses, American Art Since 1960, and Art Historical Methodology. Please welcome Dr. John Clark.
How many of you have visited Pompeii? Okay, that's a start. I first visited Pompeii in 1968. Of course, I was only 2 years old, and I don't remember a thing. That's a lie. One of the reasons I ask that is it's often hard for people to fathom what a place that existed intact on the 24th of August, 79, would have looked like buried by the ashes of one of the most massive, catastrophic volcanoes in history. What happened was a time capsule was created by the volcano, and not because of its type, but rather because it was a volcano of ash, not lava. And the ash, a Mount St. Helens type event or a Plinian event, preserved very well the artifacts, including people's bodies, and I'm not going to show any bodies today, but we do have 54 at my excavation, and architecture, painting, sculpture, foodstuffs, in other words, a time capsule. We have an eyewitness account. Pliny the Younger was studying in Mycenae, near where his uncle, Pliny the Elder, was stationed. And he saw the event and wrote down in two amazing letters, I'm not going to read them to you, amazing letters, just what he saw. But basically, what he saw, and this is Angelica Kaufman's wonderful painting of the event, there's Pliny saying, I don't think I'm going to go with Uncle. It looks a little dangerous. It sure was dangerous. That's how Pliny the Elder died. But anyway, looking off there is the volcano, and he said, I saw a pine tree. Now, we think of pine trees like this, but he was talking about an umbrella pine tree, the ones that go up and like that. In other words, he saw a mushroom cloud, and that mushroom cloud was made of ash, fine ash as well as lapilli, that then rained down for the first part of the event for about 20, maybe, well, some people say 12 to 24 hours. The sky was completely dark, and there were earthquakes and all kinds, and there was a tsunami as well. We now know that. All of this stuff was going on, and, of course, people were terrified and trying to escape, and some did, but not too many. What it left was an amazing stratigraphy, as we say in archaeology. That is a covering made of light pumice down at the bottom, heavier gray pumice working its way up to sandy ash, and then, of course, the topsoil. And you can see it perfectly here at our excavation, which we'll be talking about today, which is Villa A, sometimes called the Villa Papaya, attributed to Nero's second wife. And here we're digging back in the 1970s. I'm not digging. And there's one other thing that's not in this sweet little section here, and that is the deadly pyroclastic flow. And there you can see the pyroclastic layers very clearly, those two stripes. Those two stripes are the deadly part of a Plinian-type eruption. What happens is that mushroom cloud of ash and pumice descends back down into the cone of the volcano, and it creates pyroclastic flow. It's sometimes called the flaming mud, but it mixes with superheated steam vapor, and then it becomes this force that runs along the ground at up to 300 miles an hour, cutting down everything in its place. And, of course, human life is impossible because of the hot gases. So if you didn't get out in the first 12 hours, when the pyroclastic hit, you were goners. And so were all of the architectural structures, the trees, everything in its path. And if you want to get an idea of what that looks like, you should look at film footage from the Mount St. Helens eruption, which was a Plinian-type eruption. Not a speck of lava, but all of that material, which, of course, you have to remove. Now, this is Pompeii, only 4 meters. That's a little bit over 12 feet. We've got 8.5 meters, and so that is a 25, 27-foot fill that had to be removed in order to get to our villa. Now, where is it? Well, there's Vesuvius, and here is the beautiful Bay of Naples. Naples is over there, and we're in a modern town called Torre Annunziata, which is extremely densely populated. So it was a long time before they could expropriate the land, the Italian Ministry of Culture, in order to be able to open this up. In fact, they knew about the villa as far back as 1600 AD. And you see that we're near Pompeii. Okay, so this is what the excavations look like way back when, 1966, around the time they started. They have skimmed off the the topsoil and the top layer, and look what they found. They found this amazing painted wall, completely datable to 50 BC by people like me who are very nerdish about this sort of thing. And they started to see the beginnings of a really, really big structure. They had no idea that they were going to find 99 rooms and have to quit when they hit the 61-meter swimming pool. That's right, 61 meters. That's more than Olympic, isn't it? Or, well, no, Olympic is 100 meters. It's a huge, huge swimming pool. But anyway, they hadn't found that yet. And the important thing is they had to figure out what to do with this stuff. Now, this was the easy part. But as they went down further, they hit what? They hit the layers that had been destroyed by pyroclastic flow. The only reason that this wall is standing is that it's perpendicular to the flow. So all the walls that were cross purposes to the flow were cut down, some of them that high. I mean, looking around the site today, if you go there as a tourist, you'll say, oh, how nice, they have this lovely villa that looks just like it was, just like what it was then. You see this. I'm telling you, it's all fiction. These columns were that high. Everything you see has been, this is pieced up. You see all the pieces? From tons and tons of little pieces. So what they wanted to do was to make it a tourist site that looked real. Now, here we are a little bit later in 1977, and this is a balloon photograph. This balloon photograph shows you the balloon, and it also shows what had been excavated by then. And over here, they're digging away at the swimming pool. They haven't got it done. But what we're looking at is a 200 by 100 meter excavation. And they've put modern roofs on it. They've done all this work of putting it back together. But as I'll show you in a moment, our problem is they didn't put all the pieces back together. And that's what we're doing in digital form. So, gosh, there's so much I could talk about. I'll just point out those little ant-like figures there. Can you see them? Those are the humble student volunteers of a great professor named Wilhelmina Jashemski, who was the pioneer, an American professor, a pioneer of garden archaeology. And she said, we've got a virgin garden here. It hasn't been messed up. Let's see what we can find out. And they're looking over root casts. And these, all these white spots, you don't see them very well, are, I wasn't going to talk about this, but I love to divert, you know, go off in different directions. These root casts allowed them to understand the size of the trees and the bushes and to replant, basically, the ancient garden. They also did things like pollen analysis and a lot of other techniques to try to figure out what this garden looked like. There had never been a garden explored before in Pompeii or at Herculaneum. They just didn't, nobody bothered with it. So she invented a new kind of archaeology. By the way, she died at the age of 96, finishing her fourth book or something like that. She just, and it's come out posthumously. Okay, so what are we? We are the Aplontis Project, and this is a huge stroke of luck for me. Maybe it's because I was always very obedient to all the rules they have at Pompeii, but I have a good relationship with the Ministry of Culture. And one of my former students got me into this. I didn't want to get into it. I thought, I don't want to get into an archaeological project that is this complicated, this huge. We have 99 rooms, and there are another 40 to be discovered, just to give you an idea how big this place is. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And this is Dr. Michael Thomas, who's the head of CSI, which you see over here, which is our new center for the study of ancient Italy. And Dr. Thomas said, well, John, I think we should try to get Aplontis. And I said, are you crazy? And unfortunately, we got it. Or fortunately, I walked into the director, Pietro Giovanni Guzzo, and I said, well, and he said, yeah. And I said, Aplontis. And he said, sure. You find the funding, and it's yours. And I had a lot of calls from people who are really, really angry that they didn't get this. But anyway, so UT has it, and we've been working there for 8 years. Now, I'm getting to what our job is. Okay, so a lot of it's already, that's all they're going to excavate for a while on the ground. That's all they're going to reconstruct. The tourists can come and go. You can go there and see it. But what lies underground? Are there earlier levels to Atlantis? And believe me, that's what we have been studying. There is lots of earlier history, including earlier gardens, by the way. Another thing we needed to do was to get a really, really good publication. I had published two articles on Atlantis in the 80s, and other colleagues around the world have published on it because it's such a spectacular place, as you'll see. But there was no single monographic publication. And what we're looking at here is what these publications tend to look like. Now, they're this big, the ones we're looking at in this folder. And they open up like that. I've propped this up against, you know, a cement block or something to take this photograph. That's a pen. And it's trying to create in paper form, in the form of the books, the wonderful books we have in this library, a complete record of what's there. So what do we need to know? We need the architecture, the plans, the axonometrics. We need all of the wall paintings. We need all of the masonry, which is very boring to most people, but some people get really excited when they see a wall constructed out of several different kinds of techniques because they know that it's been redone and it gives us dating information. We need to know about all the small finds, the ceramics. We need to know about the gardens. We need pollen analysis. We need all that stuff to be in these volumes. And how are you going to do that? Well, this is a really sorry kind of fate for us, because in order to make even this book, this is the German Häuser in Pompeii series, which is the top of the top, you know, tons of money thrown into it. They actually got draftspersons to put transparent mylar in every single wall of every building in this series and trace it, which is what we're looking at, the result of that. Then go in with graphics and put in reconstructions and dotted lines and all that stuff, and that's this wall. And if you're in the book, these two illustrations facing each other across the gutter, you know, across the fold, how are you going to figure out what this is? And where are you going to find individual motifs? Well, you have to go to the plate section. You have to look for details. You have to try to, then you have to go to the description. And then if this looks like something else, then you have to go to the cross references. So it's a very complicated process and not at all intuitive. Here's another one. This is a smaller format book. You see the pencil in relation to the book. Again, exemplary publication. But this is a wall of a room. And you can see it's just a faint outline of things. And then there's a scale marker over there. And for economic purposes, they put a different drawing that fit on that page over there from a totally different space. So what do you have to do? You have to look at this, find the color plate, find the drawing, find the description, et cetera, et cetera. So how do we put the puzzle back together? And this is a good example of what pyroclastic flow can do. This is an earthquake that flipped a huge several-ton wall upside down. And so what we're looking at is a tragic mask and part of a wall and then the flipped wall. That's the painting on the opposite wall, looking up at the sky. How do we put the puzzle back together? Well, there are several ways to do this. One way is to go back here. One way is in physical reconstruction, okay? And that's what they tried to do. But unfortunately, we're looking at the wall. It's a beautiful, it doesn't look very beautiful with all this light, I must say. There's no way, I guess, to shut these lights off, huh? No, okay. Anyway, there's a beautiful wall, the one that we saw being discovered earlier on. There's the earlier on picture. Well, they found fragments, more fragments, after they discovered the wall, and they kind of stuck them back up on the wall. But then everything else had to be reconstructed in order to put a modern roof on it. How did they do it? Well, they find a fragment. There's a big fragment. But first they put it face down on a table. Then they smear concrete on the back of it with reinforcing wire. And then it has hooks on it. And then they get guidelines, like the ones you see here, to try to figure out where the puzzle pieces fit in the in the wall. Is everyone following me? Okay, good. This is one of my favorite pictures. I really worked on this one. Okay, there's several really interesting things here. And some of you have heard this before, but you know, forgive me, I can't help it. This is when Princess Margaret, none of you will remember her, she was the sister of the current queen of England, was visiting a Blontis, and she was quite of a rebel, and this is 1973, and they opened the site for her, even though it was not open to the public. And there she is shooting a photograph, which royals are not supposed to do. They're supposed to get someone else to shoot it for them. She's wearing a tie-dyed dress, and anyway, that's all very cool. And everyone's kind of gaping at the wall we were just looking at, but that guy is looking at, look at all these pieces. These are all the pieces they found after they did the modern reconstruction. And then I dug up this photograph from actually Wilhelmina Jaschemski's archives, the garden archaeologist I talked about. Her husband shot a lot of stuff he wasn't supposed to, like this completely collapsed wall. The opposite wall fell, and nobody knows that because today they covered it all up. But that whole piece there is completely invented by the process I just showed you of taking those fragments, consolidating with them with concrete and coated steel wire and hanging them back up on the wall. So this is one way of creating a place that will bring it all together. And we might say, well, that's enough, you know. But what do you do about all those leftover fragments? And what do you do about this hideous modern roof? They made it too low because afterwards they found these fragments that belong to the upper part of the decoration. And they found these fragments, and they photographed them in 73. We found them in a rubbish heap in 2008 and photographed them. What are we going to do? Can we put the puzzle together? Well, yes, some of those fragments, which they are huge. I mean, you need two guys or two strong women to to move them. We were able to reconstruct part of the upper story because it turns out the perspective lines worked, the color worked, everything was right about it. There's a close-up of it. This is our architect, and he's doing this in Photoshop and Illustrator, right? And so this is what we call a paper reconstruction. And we gave that to our guy at the lab in London, at the King's Visualization Lab, and he said, oh, well, we've been studying just this kind of upper story, and we can figure out. So our fragment ended up giving him enough to figure out the rest of it. And this is a pretty solid upper story reconstruction. But we still don't have this in living form. Now, this is to give you an idea of how these fragments were treated. They were literally thrown in a rubbish heap. When we took out, I don't know, tons and tons of stuff from here, modern things. These are pedestal sinks, which I thought were really interesting to have in there. This was supposed to be archaeological storage, but it had degraded horribly under bad management, shall we say. And this is it today. We found more fragments this summer. I'm not going to talk about them. I talked about them at my AIA talk last month. But I will mention the fact that this is how you figure them out at first. You manipulate them literally, physically, before you get into the Photoshop part of it. And so that's me and Professor Elaine Gosler from the University of Michigan. We're going to put these in an exhibition. We hope to bring the exhibition here to Austin. So what are the options for a 3D model? Enough of this stuff, you know, trying to put it into a modern reconstruction put together with reinforced concrete and baling wire. How about we can have a flexible 3D model that you can actually visit? Well, we could do a 3D Max movie. A 3D Max movie will take your model done in a program like 3D Max and then allow you to go through it with a camera fixed on specific places. Now, this doesn't give you freedom of motion. Another possibility we thought about early on and then ditched was going into Second Life. We were just had these images of people having orgies in our triclinium. So we found a, if you've been in Second Life, you know what I mean. Does this still exist? Is this still around? I don't know. So we decided to find a first-person shooter program that would actually let you control where you went and let us control all of the content. Here's the 3D Max. Whoops, sorry. Let me just go back here. Here's the 3D Max movie to give you an idea how that works. This is pretty good. This is the garden rooms along the swimming pool, which are painted with scenes of gardens. And so it allows you, the pool's to your right, it allows you to go through the rooms, see the garden rooms, navigate a little bit, look through the window. By the way, these are all these paintings are filled with birds. We have 434 birds so far, and our bird person is going nuts because she has to catalog them all. Anyway, that's one way to do it. But you see, the problem with the 3D Max movie is it only lets you go where the Max model lets you go. I wasn't navigating it. That was the choice of the modeler. So let's go to a 3D model. Let's go to it. Thing that we came to see, I hope. Okay. Oh, we're in the matrix already. I'm going to start in the garden. Well, that's easy. Let's go to the garden. Oh, I'm in a wall. Oh, garden is 56, not 26. I can never remember these numbers. Oh, I got 66. Well, anyway, let's just walk. All right. Yeah, there's the garden. And I'm going to have to jump over that. Whoops. My mouse is a little unsteady. Okay, so here we are in the garden of the villa. There's our scarp with the volcanic activity. You see the pyroclastic flows pretty clearly. Those are Dushemsky's root cavities. And this is the stairway that you take to get down into the site. What I'd like to do is just take you into the major entrance, which is this great big forehall or propylon. Notice that we've textured it with the mosaics. And I'm going to make you look at a wall. Now, this, of course, would not be in a slick, non-academic model because it's not exciting at all, is it? Is anyone excited by this wall? Oh, good. I'm glad we don't have any crackpots in the audience. This wall is very exciting to an archaeologist because it tells you all sorts of information about dating. Repairs, the villa was repaired after the earthquake of 62, which was the prelude to the eruption of 79. They should have known it was coming. And this odd feature of the villa that you have to walk down a dark corridor in order to get to the goodies. And the goodies are this interior space with a wonderful garden. The garden painting is gone, but we excavated there and found an earlier fountain complex. And it gets you into the thing that we've been focusing on today. I've been trying to just use one example. There it is again. You recognize it. That's the west wall of the atrium or the main hall of the house. Now, what can you do in a 3D model? Well, one of the things you can do is change light. So right now we're at 1,200 hours. Let me move this over a little bit. We can go through the whole cycle of 24 hours in this room and see how the light affects the interior. We can put people in it. We haven't done that yet. But in this model, an earlier version of the model, if you look down, you'd see your feet. I said, take that out. It's too weird. You can put other people in there. You can put furniture in. You can put lights in. And others, artificial light, the lamps that they burned oil in, and so on. Now, all right, that's pretty good. What if you want to know what that wall looked like? See how different this is from showing you a PowerPoint slide of that wall? It's here we really see, oh, well, this is part of a real decorative ensemble, and we're using real evidence. And then, this is the best part. We're now in the database. We're in the database that's housed in TAC, and I did this in Athens last week, and it was pretty exciting, I must say. And it's a database that allows you to drill down to more and more information. This is the scholarly apparatus of what we're doing. I mean, so far you could say, oh, yeah, you know, Clark wastes a lot of money making a game for children. No, I hope not. So what we're doing is we're looking at, there's the scholarly description. It goes on and on by Professor Regina G, who's a former graduate of UT, teaching in Montana State. An amazing descriptive catalog that tells you exactly what's in here. This includes a bibliography. It includes all the stuff you want to know. And then we get related photographs. Password. There's a photograph of that wall. And I want it high res. I knew that was going to happen. That's what I get. That's hubris, right? Let's see if the medium res. There's the medium res. We might not have the high res loaded. I think that's the problem. So that's just to give you a current photograph. Even better. I'm going to go back to this. What if we wanted to find what this place looked like, this room looked like, when it was being excavated? Oh, this is really rich. These are photographs that I found, and I'm telling you, it wasn't easy, because they were trying to hide them from me. And you can see why. There's that wall I was talking about that had been totally collapsed, right, and covered up so no one would know what happened. And there's workmen with a hose squirting off the fragments. Honestly, I mean, this is like beyond belief. I mean, a conservator would look at this and just drop dead. Yeah, and they've got plaster all over the place. And there, this is very valuable. It was only 2 years ago that we found a drawing that told us that, another thing no one had ever recorded, that there was a cistern under the atrium floor, under this square here, which, as you can see, was totally rebuilt. It's a catch basin for the water that comes through the hole in the roof, the compluvium. It goes on and on. I mean, there's so much information here that you can get to right away. I'll just do another random one. Let's see. That's interesting. That's a flip photograph in the files of the archive itself. It's digitized backwards. Got to fix this one. I mean, it's in there backwards. Now I better not show any more. I think we're really getting into trouble. What is this? This gives you an idea of how they have to put this thing together. They have all this scaffolding up there trying to hold those pieces on the wall. So, I mean, you know, your casual walk through the villa as a tourist has no information whatsoever, and this allows you to, and that is flipped around too for some reason. Anyway, okay, got some work to do. So all of this gives us an idea of the possibilities of an interactive, database-connected 3D model. And I'll stop there for questions. If you want me to show you some other really nice rooms, I will, but only if you really ask nice. Any questions? Yes, please. Oh, no. Laura.
John.
Hi.
Is your database accessible to anybody? I mean, like, how can you get access to what you just showed us?
It's password protected right now.
Plans to make it publicly accessible?
Yes. And this depends on an accord with the Italian Ministry of Culture, because what they would like to do is make sure that nobody downloads those photographs, because they get a couple hundred bucks a photograph for public, if it goes into a non-academic publication. If it were to go into an academic publication, then that's fine, but they need to know who's using what. So. And the other thing I haven't talked about is the ebook. That's a whole other deal. But in addition to the model, where as Roxanne mentioned in her introduction, in addition to the model, of course we're producing a publication, and it's born digital, meaning that there's no paper involved whatsoever, And that Born Digital publication has a lot of this material in it. And we maybe for volume two, link it to the database. So the idea is to make this accessible as possible. Yes?
How did you get in with the Italian?
Sheer luck. I speak Italian very well, and I think that's one lesson that everyone who ever wants to work in a foreign country must learn. Speak the language. Never take English as the second best, because you're going to get second best. I was able to forge friendships there in that way. Not close friendships, but let's say everybody knew what everyone was saying all the time, and I've worked there for 40 years. So I remember in the early days, it might help those of you who are timid about languages, I used to have to write a script for telephone calls. But it works. You start out with buongiorno, come sta, c'è la dottoressa Stephanie, si, benissimo, and you go, and you work. Anybody else? Yeah.
Have the budget cuts and budget problems in Italy affected your work specifically, or because you have outside funding?
They haven't put a penny into it. It's all our money. I can tell you the money thing. It's just unbelievable how much this costs. This model is hugely expensive. And one of my reasons for trying to talk about it is to find people who know Unity and who would want to volunteer, because we were paying a lot of money to people to do this. And it was grant money, but still. So what's left to do in the model? We have beautiful sculpture, unbelievable sculpture from the gardens, found in place, and things that were found out of place. We want to put it back in. We've got it 3D scanned, but we need to put it into the model. So you can walk through the garden, see the plants that Jastrzemski knew were there, replant the gardens, put the sculpture in, get the water moving, all that stuff. I mean, that swimming pool is huge. Oh, I feel like jumping in the swimming pool. I can't help it. I'm going to go to the swimming pool. Let's just go there. I'll take my favorite route past where we have lunch. Oh, I bet I could squeeze along. This wall, by the way, is holding me up. This is the wall of the Sarno Canal, which is a present that was constructed. I'm running through the garden here really fast. I've got to jump. The swimming pool. Okay, the swimming pool had a row of sculptures alongside it. All along here, many found in situ, trees behind it, water. Back here, a wonderful fountain, statues, and so on, and none of that's in here yet.
Yeah, I have a question. Can you discuss the evidence that supports belief that the villa belonged to Poppaea Sabina? And also, is this villa unique among the Campanian sites in being linked to an historical personage?
Okay, there's an amphora was found with the inscription Secundo Poppaeae, and that means to Secundus, a slave probably, property of Poppaea. But the problem is that Poppaea is a gens name, meaning a family or clan name, and so there were lots of Poppaeae in the area, including the owner of the house of the Menander and probably the insula of Ariana at Pompeii. So all it means is it belonged to someone belonging to the gens Poppaea. And that's as far. So in our official publication, we call it the Villa of Poppaea in Villa A, Oplontis Villa A of Poppaea in quotation marks.
Has there been any collaboration with the Ercolano Museum, the virtual museum there?
Oh, I know them quite well. Yeah, I know Gentiluomo, he's one of the modelers, and I visited there and El Capasso, but there's no collaboration whatsoever because he wants to make money on it, and his stuff is very thin. If you look at his texture modeling and so on, he's using really old technology and just trying to dun as much money out of it as possible. That's my kind remarks about that. Yes? Oh, my gosh, how many people lived there? There's a huge slave quarter. The slave quarter could have packed in maybe 200 or more slaves. And the villa has, so far we have kind of rooms, about 80 rooms, and there's probably another 40 to still yet be discovered. But density for rich people is very small compared, let's say, to a city block with workers in it. So as many people as wanted to be there, let's say they could have hosted, I'd say, about 200 guests plus the guest slaves, which would be another 600. Yeah. So it's huge. Does that help? Did I answer that well? Okay, yeah. But you know, obviously a wealthy person, when they're not there, they just have a few people looking after it. The villa was abandoned at the time of the eruption, and there may have been 5 or 6 people. There were no kitchen provisions. There weren't any bodies found there. It had been so badly damaged by the earthquake of 62, it seems that they were selling it off piece by piece. They were selling the marbles. They stripped all the marbles. They were getting rid of the sculpture, all the expensive stuff. And oh, returning to your question about how prestigious this villa is, we do have one really interesting fact. It has all marble columns along the swimming pool, and nobody in that whole area, even the Villa of the Papyri or the Villa Ariana Stabia, have marble columns. They're always made out of of brick and cement, and then faux marbled on the outside. So, and they were selling them off. They had sold most of them off. And marble capitals, beautiful stuff. We have most of that. So that tells us that this is someone with a lot of money. So that's on the positive side for the Poppaea connection. Yes.
Have any other archaeological sites been put into a 3D form like this?
Not like this. They've done various things. They've done LIDAR. They've done 3D Studio Max. And they've done what I call dead reconstructions, where you're just still. In other words, getting an artist to do a reconstruction from a particular point of view. But nobody has done this. And especially nobody has got it linked to a database. So sometimes I wonder if we should even bother with a book. You just give people the model in the database. But no, what the book has, and I'll show it to you. I was fixing to do that anyway. Where are we? What the book has. An ISBN number, that's always comforting. What it has are 42 collaborating scholars, each of them taking a specific point of view. And so we have people from the isotopic stone analyzers, these chemists who work on ancient stone. They sampled every stone, every sculpture in the villa and all the stone thresholds. We have that really highly technical information, which tells us what quarries all these precious marbles came from, give us an idea of the commerce and trade in marble. Two people like me talking about the artist procedures in creating this prospectus we saw in the second style walls that we were looking at. We have a huge range of studies. I found out what anthropology is. Anthropology is the study of ancient charcoal. So that's in volume one. Volume one's about ready to come out. I have the proofs back from the copy editor, and it will then launch. And when it launches, it will be available through the American Council of Learned Society site, which is, we subscribe to it, so you'll have it for free. You won't have to pay for it. If you want to subscribe individually, it's $40 a year. Anyway, it gives you 6,000 books. It's pretty good. So that's what you can't do with a 3D model. That is marshal the work of scholars who are bringing in information from all over the ancient Mediterranean and creating arguments and dialogue about what's actually going on there. We have some disagreements, and that's really good. questions? If we have a moment, I'll show my fragments. A few more reconstructions. They're pretty juicy. This is what I presented in Athens. And I thought I'd bring it in case something like this happened. Okay, we have the biggest and most beautiful wall of the villa, which is the east wall of what had to be a reception space. Oh, one of the things we're able to do is recreate the ancient landscape. But I didn't even mention that. The geology is incredible here because by doing deep coring, going down 90 feet beneath the modern surface, we've been able to determine where this villa sat. It sat on a cliff overlooking the ocean. Today, it sits in the middle of this nasty town. And you have and the sea is literally, because of all the volcanic material that filled it up, is literally a kilometer away. So we could find that out by coring. And the coring allows us to recreate the view out of this room. Right now, this is what it looks like. The west wall was never excavated because it's under a modern road. So last summer, in May, on May 20th, I'll never forget it, I thought we were all done with fragments, right? And underneath a heap of stuff in yet another one of those storage rooms, I said, "What's that?" And one of the archaeologists on the project had told them, "Oh, don't bother, that's not important. Yeah, that's nothing." Well, it was really important to Clark because it ended up being pieces of the lost and unexcavated west wall that had been knocked off the top of the building. In other words, the top of the wall by the pyroclastic. So this is our working method. You saw that earlier photograph where we have them on the floor. This is Tim Liddell, our architect, one of our architects, saying, you know, making various comments and saying, does this fit here, does this fit there? He's the puzzle expert. These are leftover pieces. I figured out where this one goes, all right? And that's how it fits into the reconstructed wall. And that's the whole wall. We now have evidence that the decoration of the opposite wall was mirror reversal of the other wall. Of course, this is not rocket science for someone who studies ancient wall painting, because we know that they gridded the walls in order to make absolute mirror reversal decorations on the right and left walls. And then the back wall of the room would have a different feature. Here's another one. This is really cool. This, when I was studying it in the 1980s, I didn't even see it. I thought it was blank. And then someone said, "Oh, you know, there's a drawing somewhere that shows what that looked like," because all of the paint had faded. They treated it wrong. And this is in a beautiful little room. And then one day in 2008, the archivist at Pompeii said, "I think I have something that will make you happy." And it blew me away. It was a photograph taken before all that damage occurred in 1966. And these photographs had been lost for 40 years. And that's the photo close-up. Look what it is. It's this amazing scene of a harbor, a little harbor, like the one that must have been below Oblontis, by the way, with walls around it, and then people kind of conversing and doing stuff and gesturing like Romans do, a couple of fishermen in a boat in the middle. I mean, you know, it's not great art, but it is great, isn't it? And this allowed us to put it back into the 3D model. So if you go into the 3D model and you hit the R button, which I did to take the screenshot, you'll have the whole thing as it must have looked like then. Even the mosaics, the floor is almost all gone, but we had a little piece of mosaic and we're able to reconstruct what these little bedside carpets were. These are alcoves where you would put a couch. That was cut through later on. And the other thing is, it allows you to understand that this is a cultural property that changes over time. It's not eternal. Look at these photographs. 1975, this is right when Jastrzemski was about to dig. They left a layer there so that she could dig out, or her crew could dig out the root cavities. And they've roofed part of the villa. The other part isn't even excavated. This is 2000 when it was planted the way that Jastrzemski had said, that there would be boxwood hedges and these trees along the side. And this is after they ripped everything out that she had put in, and this upstart, crazy woman actually, decided that she would replant it the way she liked it. And literally, what are we supposed to believe? There's no, you know, you have to go back to the scientific evidence. You have to go back to the archaeology. And who knows what it'll look like in 20 years. It may have all fallen down with another earthquake. And so we're preserving cultural heritage. We're trying to keep this for the future. And that's why we've gone digital. Here's another example. This wall, when I showed you a photograph earlier of this wall toppled and flipped over, the conservationists, who were not very good, lost everything here. Everything. I found photographs that allowed us to fill it in. That's what it looked like, or a pretty good facsimile of it. And I'll just point out a few details. Oh, no, I won't. Okay, and I'm going to stop right after this. This room looks like zero, nothing, nothing. It was paved with beautiful marble and had the only wood paneling we know from any place in the ancient world. And I won't tell you what it took to do this, but there it is. And that's our ebook. Amen.